the places I remember all my life, though some have changed.
One of the classic tracks off of the Beatles' Rubber Soul album, In My Life, which includes that line about the places I remember, which is the title of a new collection of photographs by Henry Grossman, who took more photos of the Beatles over a longer time than any other photographer, over 6,000 of them, many of which appeared in Time magazine and Life magazine between 1964 and 1968. The book, Places I Remember, My Time with the Beatles, has about 1,000 of those photos in it and an intro by Paul McCartney. And since I'm a huge Beatles fan, I heard about this and I said, let's get Henry on the phone, and here he is. Good morning, Henry.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing wonderfully. Thank you very much. I see in the book that the first time you even met the Beatles, let alone photographed them, was at the Ed Sullivan Show on February 9th, 1964. Did you volunteer for that assignment because you were a fan?
No, not at all. Time magazine assigned me to go there and shoot. I was aware of who the Beatles were from the press, but I was not really a fan as such. I wasn't listening to their music particularly. I was more interested in classical music. So, I became a fan after I got to know them a bit of them, not of the music at that time, but of them.
But through the years, did you become a fan of their music, or did you still think to yourself,
I like a lot of it now, yes, through the years, as you said.
So how did your relationship with them grow from that moment on? How did you get them to agree to allow you to spend time with them in some of their most intimate moments?
I just became friends with them. I went down to Nassau with them. I stayed there for maybe a little over 2 weeks, and we went to Austria, and then I went to London with them. And along the way, George asked me to if I could do some pictures of portraits of him and his wife, Patty. And I did, and it wasn't his wife yet, but I went over there, and then George said, hey, let's go over and visit John, and there we went, and I was a friend.
So the times you were with them in Nassau and the Bahamas and then in Austria, was that during the filming of their second movie, Help?
That's right, exactly. It was during Help.
So at that point, not only had Beatlemania struck, but they'd already had a hit with Hard Day's Night. By the way, how much was their life like Hard Day's Night, which really shows the raucous life going on around them in Beatlemania, but how they were locked up in hotels and cars most of the time? Was that true?
That's a very good question. Yes, it was very much true. When we were in Atlantic City, a week after the Ed Sullivan show, I went to Atlantic City and spent a day with them and photographing them at a concert. And I took Ringo, how do you like visiting America, seeing America? And he took me over to the window and pointed out a parking lot down below and a brick wall opposite. And he said, Henry, this is all we're seeing of America. And they couldn't even go out of the hotel because they were being pursued so avidly. Even in London, the crowds were amazing. And outside of their homes, John had to get up. We were in John's living room, and John had to get up and ask some kids if they would please leave them quietly for a while.
Was that the case in the Bahamas and in Austria as well, or just in the English-speaking countries?
In Austria, there were a lot of people around, but not in Nassau, no. We were on a sort of kind of beach locations, and there weren't a lot of people around for that.
You had an earlier collection of your photographs called Kaleidoscope Eyes, which had some amazing photos from an evening you spent with them in Abbey Road while they were making Sgt. Pepper's. Can you take us inside that building a little bit and tell us what it's like to be there as they're creating it? Because what I understand is much of the music wasn't written and prepared and produced in their minds ahead of time. It was sitting down and trying to figure it out and just make it up as they went along. Was that true?
I think you're absolutely right. As a matter of fact, while I was there in the evening, Paul came in and sat down at the piano and started playing a melody. And then he said, hey, guys, listen to this. They all came over, started playing and listening, and that's what they worked on. And by the end of the evening, I hardly recognized the melody. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds is what they were working on. And they didn't have music with them. They were not reading music. They were just making it up as they went along, which is very creative.
So would it be that either Paul or John or maybe the two of them would present it to George and Ringo, and then they would figure out, okay, well, here's what I'm going to do with my guitar part, here's what we'll do with the bass, here's what we'll do with the drums, and George Martin would get involved and say, okay, let's add in these instruments? Was it that sort of thing where they were literally building a song from the ground up in the studio?
Yes, they were, and I was not aware of Paul and John leading the group as such during that evening, but obviously everybody contributed beautifully to it. I'm recalling some pictures from Kaleidoscope Eyes where Paul is sitting at Ringo's drums beating on them during a break, and Ringo said to in an interview at another time, every time I get up from my drums, I come back, and there's Paul beating on them.
And, of course, later when he did his solo work, Paul did play the drums and the bass and the guitar and the piano, and they were literally solo albums. Maybe he was rehearsing for the times that he'd have a post-Ringo life the night you were there.
They probably were, but, you know, these are all very witty, intelligent, charming, talented guys. And the fact that the four of them got together into one group is even more unusual and startling, and I think that's wonderful. I'm not sure that... I don't want to use the word polymorph. They were wonderfully talented and could do almost anything as far as I was concerned. But the real charm was in the fun they were having and who they were. Ringo saw the book about 3 or 4 weeks ago in L.A., and he said, oh, my gosh, I never thought these pictures would survive this long. And it reminds me of how lively and how much fun we were in those days.
Talking with Henry Grossman, who's got a new collection of photos of his years with the Beatles. It's called Places I Remember My Time with the Beatles. He took over 6,000 pictures of them. Did they ever say to you, Henry, don't take out your camera now. I don't want you to take a picture of this.
No, they never said, don't take out your camera. As a matter of fact, I went with them. I just knew not to. I wasn't trying to bother them and set up pictures. I took what was going on. As a matter of fact, I was sitting at breakfast with the guys, and George came in. And he looked so unusual. And he had just woken up, and his hair was ruffled and everything else. He looked very vulnerable. And as he sat down, I took off my camera from around my shoulder, and I said, George, I got to shoot this. And I shot it, but I wasn't shooting pictures of the guys at breakfast. That's just an instance where I felt I had to shoot a picture. No one ever said to me, hey, don't shoot this now. Brian Epstein did not want me to distribute the pictures in London. Brian was their manager. And he called me and said, Henry, Life is syndicating these in London. We've never even let a British photographer into their home. The next day, he called me. He sent me a cable. And he said, I've just seen the pictures. Can I have a set disregard phone call?
The work was that good. Were you with the Beatles when they heard that Brian had died?
Yes, I was with them in Wales with the Maharishi that day. And Time Magazine had given me, Time Magazine was preparing a cover story, a cover article on the Beatles. I'd been shooting them in London and shooting Brian at home in London the week before. And, I didn't want to go to Wales because it was a long trip and I'd gotten a lot of stuff from the Beatles that week. And Time Magazine said, we'll give you a car and a driver. So they did. And, when we got the news that Brian had died, everybody was scrambling to get back. And I said to myself, oh God, I have this car. I offered the ride, and Paul and Jane Asher took me up on it, and we rode back to London together, about a six-hour ride.
They were completely distraught, obviously, for this man who helped steer them.
I just rode as a friend. I was not asking them questions about Brian or any of that. I was just being a presence.
Before the news of Brian's death ended the trip to the Maharishi, I got to be honest, as a longtime Beatles fan, but as a complete outsider to anything related to the group, that whole trip always seemed silly to me. What was it like being in the midst of it?
It was not silly. They were really interested, and I have so many pictures of them talking with the Maharishi and then listening to him, and it was a very serious time. They were really involved at that time.
That their interest in the Maharishi came because of George's interest in Indian culture, which grew out of his interest in the sitar. Now, you have to verify something for me, Henry. I heard that it was you who saw a sitar on George's house, on the wall of George's house. You asked him if he could play it, and he said no. And you said, George, you're George Harrison. Get somebody to teach you how to play this thing. And so he got Ravi Shankar. Is that true?
Something like that, yes. And first of all, the sitar was on his wall, but it wasn't decoration. He reached up, took it down, started tuning it. And I said to him, when he said he couldn't get anybody to teach him how to play it, I said, George, you make a lot of money. And he smiled. And I said, you could probably afford to bring the best sitar teacher in India here. I didn't suggest he go to India, but he did go to India and studied there. And that was not my instigation. It was maybe it planted something in his mind. But a year later, when I went back to visit George after he'd been back to India or been to India, he greeted me at the door in bare feet and said, looked down at my shoes, and he was dressed in Indian garb and said, Henry, would you like to take your shoes off? Which I did, and that was an Indian time for him. And he had a dinner party that he was out at his home, and with some Indian musicians as well. So Ravi wasn't there at that time, but it was a marvelous time. And he was a very advanced soul and very into philosophy, and just a marvelous mind.
In that year that passed, how proficient had he gotten at the sitar?
He wasn't playing the sitar that much while I was there visiting. I really don't know how proficient he was, had become, but I'm assuming since he his interest, he would have taken it as far as he could go. I know I toured Ravi and George were doing a tour in 1974 after the Beatles were over, and George asked me to tour with them as their photographer, and I did for a while. Picking and choosing where I photographed them. But it was an Indian group with the regular American musicians on the tour, so that George had a lot of time to listen and play.
You spent time not only with the Beatles in the studio and at their concerts, but obviously in their homes as well. I'm curious about some of the parties you went to with these guys, which you took photos at as well. What was a Beatles party like? Did they perform?
No, there was no performance. As a matter of fact, at George's home, one of them was a potluck dinner. People, friends of theirs, same age as they were, brought dishes over and cooked in the kitchen and did whatever, heated it up in the kitchen and that kind of thing. And George was sitting on the floor with an Indian musician, Ali Akbar Khan, and David Crosby from Crosby, Stills, and Nash was there as a friend. It was just a... No, there was no performance. I don't think I ever went backstage at a performance, as a matter of fact, and I only photographed them performing in Atlantic City once, and that was at the beginning.
Why not?
They were not performing. As a matter of fact, when we went over to John's house, George had his guitar with him, and we were talking, and while the women were in the other room talking about curtains and other things, John and George pulled out their guitars and were playing together, just sort of riffing, I guess. And John's son, Julian, who was a toddler at that time, just watched them. I have wonderful pictures of him looking up at these two guys playing guitar at home.
I mentioned in the intro, Henry, that you took over 6,000 photos of the Beatles between 64 and 68. Did you retain relationships with them after that, through their solo years?
Kind of. I was in touch with George, but I was not an avid touch. I was a very busy working photographer, and this was just an assignment, as it turned out, with a group of friends that I enjoyed, but it was more during the Beatle time that whenever I was in London doing something else, I would go over and visit.
So you,
but I didn't go back to England a lot after that, and I really was, you know, going to different countries doing stills and movies and shooting a royal wedding in Liechtenstein and going to the White House and stuff like that. So I was busy running around a lot. I was really joyous for what they were becoming and how marvelous they had become. George said to me on one of the visits, "Said God, Henry, who knows how long this is going to last?" And that was 50 years ago.
Yeah, I was going to ask, since you weren't around them all that much, was there any way for you to know that things were falling apart at the end in 69 and 70?
I had no idea other than what I read. No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I had no idea that they were not going to continue as the Beatles. I think I knew that, I think the Abbey Road session that I did with Kaleidoscope Eyes was the last recording session as Beatles. They complained that they couldn't hear their music because of the screaming at the concerts.
One of the last things in your book, Henry, is a brief encounter you had with George and John in New York. I think it was probably around Thanksgiving time in 1974 when John made a surprise appearance at an Elton John concert at Madison Square Garden, probably the last time he performed live in concert for a crowd that size. What was the meeting with George and John like?
They had been friends. They were friends. It was marvelous. It was George's tour, and it was nice to see John. I also saw him here in New York later at the Beacon Theater near on 74th and Broadway. John was living at 72nd in Central Park, and I lived at 76th Street. And I did bump into John, for example, on the street with Yoko, and I just talked with him for a while and went on. I deliberately stayed away from visiting, from asking if I could take pictures, because I knew how they had been pursued and hounded by the press and people, wanting things from them. So I regret it now, but I wish I had gone to take pictures, ask John if I could take some pictures at home.
At that point in 74, when you would run into them on the street, were they just walking along being undisturbed by people? Had the
absolutely. As a matter of fact, we met and they were walking to a little Italian garden restaurant on 71st and Columbus, unrecognized or unbothered, shall we say.
Isn't that interesting that in the decade you had known them from 64 to now 74, you'd gone from the height of Beatlemania where things were so crazy with fans that they couldn't even leave their hotel to, I'm just going to go out on the street and Yoko and I are going to walk up here and we're going to get some dinner. And nobody bothered them along the way. That's a remarkable decade of change.
Yes, it is. I hadn't thought of that. It is. But it's also Americans. We don't... I guess maybe we would have if they... Yes, they were on the street. I'm remembering now there were crowds all over the place at the Delmonico Hotel and outside of Ed Sullivan, this kind of thing. Yes, there were crowds. You're right. In that decade, things had begun to change.
Henry, is it true that your pictures were just sitting around until a couple of years ago when either you or somebody on your staff discovered them and said, let's make these available again?
Well, what happened was CurveEditor.com, these guys who published the two books that I've done, were publishing a book of their own called Recording the Beatles, which went over all the tape and the microphones and the sessions that they had been doing at Abbey Road. They came to me for a picture, and when they saw the slew of pictures I had, they came back to me and said, We want to do a book of your pictures. And I said, why? And they said, you have the largest unseen photograph collection of the Beatles. And so we went through it, and we began choosing pictures. And Kaleidoscope Eyes is just one night chronologically, about 220 pictures of them recording that night at Abbey Road, how they worked. I was a fly on the wall. I didn't pose any of them for that. And I just had a wonderful time with them as a friend, I guess.
And Places I Remember contains over 1,000 photos that you took out of that massive collection of more than 6,000. I'm guessing that as you look through them, it was tough to choose because each one must have sparked a memory.
A lot of memories. I said to somebody, I think I said it to my son the other day, it's like visiting old friends to look through that book.
Yeah. As I mentioned, over 1,000 photographs and an intro by Paul McCartney. The book is called Places I Remember, My Time with the Beatles. Henry Grossman, a great pleasure talking to you. Sometime we'll have to talk about some of the other people who you've had on the other side of your lens.
Oh, I'd love that. Another time, but thank you, Paul.
Thank you for joining me this morning here on the Big 550 KTRS.